Hello, welcome to Series 2 of Unknown Warriors. I'm Michael Baker. In this episode, I want to look at what we might call the Underground War. More precisely, the wars going on alongside and fueled by the interstate conflict that raged on the major battlefronts in Europe. We're talking here about partisan resistance, secret subversion, civil wars between proxies, and popular activism and defiance of one kind or another. Apart from rather British accounts of the French resistance and a fascination with the secret agents dropped behind enemy lines by SOE, Britain's Special Operations Executive, remarkably little has been written in English on this subject, certainly not from a Europe-wide perspective. The historian Halik Kachansky is perhaps best known for her book The Eagle Unbowed, a history of Poland and the Poles in the Second World War. In 2022, her latest book, Resistance, was published, a sweeping account of the underground war across Europe between 1939 and 1945. In 2023, the book was awarded the prestigious Wolfson History Prize. I began our discussion by asking Halik why a comprehensive history of the subject has only been written now.
Well, most people see resistance as meaning the French resistance, or SOE, or in the case of the Poles, the Polish resistance. So those are the subjects people know about, they are the subjects that sell. There has been a previous history of all the countries, but it was done on a country-by-country basis, and I felt that was useful, but of limited interest. I wanted to compare what happened in each country to its neighbour or across Europe, particularly the East-West divide.
Was that because linguistically it was challenging to do a comprehensive European history?
I think there were several reasons. One is linguistically, certainly. I have to confess I do not speak all 22 languages that I'd need to in order to study the archives and literature of every country. I could read French and I could read Polish, but otherwise I relied on translations. Another side is that it is only since the fall of communism that Eastern Europe has been able to write its true own history. And some of those studies have been translated into English, and those are the ones that I could use.
So what does this new comprehensive history tell us that we didn't know before or that we didn't understand before about the resistance landscape?
Well, I think people don't understand the difference between how the Germans behaved in the East, where they considered they had a mission, and the West, where they considered their occupation was just a function. In the East, their mission was Lebensraum, the extension of German living space, and this involved the elimination of the population living there. First of all, in Poland, where they started with the extermination of the Jews, and then also extending into the Soviet Union. That meant that immediately the Germans invaded, their policies were brutal eradication of nationhood and the enslavement of the population. In the West, however, they were prepared to work with either collaborating regimes or with collaborating civil service if the government had gone abroad. And their function there was the exploitation of economic resources, but unless the population misbehaved, they were not going to take any action against it.
This much more punitive German attitude in the East was on display from the outset. To take a typical example, shortly after Poland was occupied in 1939, when posters celebrating Independence Day went up on the walls of houses in Krakow, the Germans took out one man from each house and shot him. In contrast, similar patriotic demonstrations in Norway and Belgium in 1940 were ignored or led to arrests and warnings, but no worse. This relative normality in the occupied West meant people were initially reluctant to rock the boat, not least because the Germans offered some stability of employment. So, a year into the occupation of Western Europe, we find over 2 million of its workers had volunteered for paid jobs inside the German Reich. Your book looks at resistance in its broadest sense, that's to say from the rather passive attentisme of people who sympathised but were biding their time, right through to resistance cells to militarised partisan warfare. Can you give me a picture of this very varied landscape and how the landscape shifted under changing circumstances?
Well, I'll take the second part first, because I've put my book into three chronological sections. And I think this is important to understand the resistance narrative as a whole, because in the period from 1939 until the German invasion of the Soviet Union, there was very little point in resisting. In Poland, it was clear because the Germans were intent on destroying Poland as a state and enslavement of the Poles. That did not apply in another eastern country, the Czech Protectorate, because there they had important armament factories which the Germans needed to exploit. But in the West, very little happened against the Germans. Really, the German occupation just added an extra level of administration and the unpleasantness of the sight of German banners all over the place. The other thing to consider is the position of the Allies. By June 1941, there was no Allied soldier, as part of an army, left on European soil. So the question was, why resist? Obviously, the German occupation was going to last forever, so it made much more sense to, if not necessarily collaborate, then at least just get on with your own life as best you could. But then that changes with the German invasion of the Soviet Union, because the failure of the Germans to take Moscow by Christmas 1941 meant the war would now be a long one. And so two German policies were adopted. One, the Holocaust, which we'll leave to one side because that's such a huge subject. But the second was forced labour. Now, this brought the impacts of occupation into everyone's home across Europe, including in France, Belgium and Holland, where the impact had not been felt until then. And that led to young men fleeing into the countryside and into the mountains, where the resistance was now forced to become organised in order to look after these people. Not all of them became armed resistors later, but there was a pool of manpower that could be potentially exploited. And the second point of that is that the collaborating regimes and civil services had actually assisted the Germans, both with the rounding up of the Jews and with the enforcement of the forced labour decrees. So the idea that had been prevalent in the first part of the war, that these regimes collaborated for the benefit of their people, that they were a shield for their people against the worst of German policies, no longer applied. And so people became, what I would say, more resistance-minded. Instead of seeing the early resistors as terrorists, they now started feeling sorry for these poor young men having to sleep rough, hiding from German policies that were being imposed on them by the local native authorities. And then the final section is after the surrender of Italy in September 1943. At this point, the Allies are doing much better. They landed in Europe. In the east, the Soviets are advancing fast on the Polish frontier. It's clear that the Germans will lose the war at some stage, but it is now in the foreseeable future rather than sometime in the distant future. And so resistance, and indeed armed resistance, becomes a reasonable attitude to adopt.
There's a lot written about collaborators, who in a sense are the other side of the coin from resistance. But collaboration is quite a loaded term, isn't it? There's very many different kinds of collaboration, very different degrees of it. And it would depend a lot on the circumstances within an occupied country, wouldn't it?
It did very much. I mean, there was political collaboration, like in the Czech Republic, President Hacha urged people to collaborate with the Germans And indeed, a Czech journalist said quite openly, well, if we can't sing with the angels, let's howl with the wolves. France is a very different state because Pétain met Hitler, something that the French would prefer us to forget, and said he was in favour of collaboration. What he meant by collaboration is still being argued over to this day. I think a lot of French collaboration stemmed from the fact they felt, OK, the Germans have got the whole of Europe, but surely there's enough room for another major state on this continent, and then let it be French. The kind of view of Pétain is saying that they collaborated because they wanted the French prisoners of war, of which the Germans had 1.5 million, to be returned to them. But some pretty dodgy decisions were made in the name of collaboration, and that only became worse later in the war as opinion split, not only in France but elsewhere, between those in favour of further collaboration and those who were purely on the side of resistance.
The Vichy regime under Marshal Pétain in France's southern half, the so-called unoccupied zone, initially had considerable French support. Many people saw it as a welcome return to more conservative values after the aggressively secular pre-war Third Republic. They believed Pétain was saving France's honour and shielding its people from the worst of German domination. But unprompted by the Germans, Vichy quickly enacted its own anti-Jewish laws, and its police force, spearheaded from 1943 by the extremist paramilitary milice, was soon rounding up Jews, communists, and young men eligible for forced labour in Germany, as well as mounting aggressive actions against the resistance. Over time, this looked more and more like outright collaboration, simply doing the Germans' dirty work for them. Collaboration created quite a complicated situation, didn't it, in different countries? Because you had Quislings and you had collaborators who would become targets in Western countries, but in the East, ideological opponents like the communists or the Soviets in Central and Eastern Europe. So you seem to have a situation much more like a civil war than simply resistors against the Germans.
Well, certainly in Norway, Quisling's NS party was their only legitimate party. And in order to hold any post in even local government or any professional association, you had to be a member of the party. Now, not all those people were collaborators. They joined the party solely to keep their jobs. But there were other collaborators, like the anti-Bolshevik legions in France and the Netherlands and Belgium. And these were out-and-out collaborators. They were generally withdrawn from the Eastern Front after a short time and would then become, in Denmark, the Schalburg Corps. In France, remembered as the Milice. Other people collaborated some of the time, not all of the time, really to stay alive. If you think about it, if you go underground, who's going to feed your family? And so people needed to work, and their only employers were the Germans. Certainly most of the factory produce went to Germany. Most of the agriculture, most of the food was seized by the Germans. There were very, very few jobs that you could do that would not bring you into direct contact with the Germans. After the war, that was understood. Divisions were drawn between ideological collaboration, which was punished highly, and those who collaborated out of need. In Eastern Europe, collaboration was anyone who was not communist and not in favour of the Soviet Union. That meant the persecution of those who had been in the true resistance and the promotion of those who had done very little but had made a lot of noise about it and were in favour of the imposition of communist rule.
Some 1.5 million Soviet citizens fought for the Germans, so it's not always useful to call them collaborators. Many in Ukraine, Belarus and the Baltic states were essentially nationalists who wanted to get rid of Soviet rule. Hundreds of thousands volunteered as auxiliaries. Drawn from locals and Soviet POWs, the more trusted elements were given arms by the Germans and served as concentration camp guards or anti-partisan police units. Given that starvation was the fate of most Soviet POWs held by the Germans, working for the enemy offered a choice hard to refuse.
I presume that homegrown fascist groups would have liked the Germans to have let them run the country. But actually, in some cases, the Germans didn't do this, although it was offered.
The Germans wanted to remain in charge, and they had the very early example of Quisling, who, the moment the Germans invaded, declared himself head of the Norwegian government. And that outcry against Quisling warned the Germans to be careful about just how popular fascism was in other European states. The leader of the Danish fascist movement, someone said, well, why don't you seize the government? And he said, well, I'm not going to be leading the country on the backs of German bayonets. In France, again, it was more complicated. The Germans did not want to collaborate with people like Marcel Dayat and other of the main collaborating parties because they recognised the unpopularity of them. Only in 1944, as D-Day was approaching, did those arch-collaborators and arch-fascists actually get invited into the French government. And that led to, again, more divisions within French society.
It was a way of occupying the country administratively that was more effective. Was that what was behind the German thinking, where they rejected offers from right-wing groups?
Well, they didn't need to unsettle the country more than necessary, because if the French under Pétain were willing to collaborate with the Germans, why impose unpopular people on top of them? And while Belgian and Dutch civil servants were prepared to do the Germans' bidding, why impose rule from there? In the Netherlands, it was different. They did slowly change local government to the right-wing NSB. But they were very aware of unsettling the country. And again, an example comes from Norway, probably the country that provided the most important examples of the power of unarmed resistance. From February 1942, when Quisling was given free rein, he caused utter chaos to such an extent that in the end, the German Reichskommissar, Terboven, said, "Stop that, you are unsettling the country."
The really familiar part of this story to most people, I think, will be the role played by clandestine resistance cells within an occupied country. It's clearly the most popular angle to write about. What struck me forcibly was, firstly, just how dangerous this work was, and secondly, how complicated it could be where you had different resistance groups with opposing agendas vying for dominance.
It was highly dangerous because, unfortunately, the resistance groups had to learn time and time and time again about security risks, who to trust, not to trust more people than strictly necessary. The reason they still survived was their resilience. Their friends would be arrested and tortured to death, and yet the resistance would carry on. The other point of danger is what I always say is part of the moral dilemma of resistance, that it's one thing for you yourself to decide to take a risk, but the German policies of collective responsibility, something happens near this village, the village gets wiped out. Something happens in the town, hostages get executed. It's not you who will be punished, unless, of course, they do catch you, but strangers or communities. But the danger was there, they were easily penetrated, and treachery happened from a variety of motives, sometimes political, sometimes financial, and the saddest one of all, love. Part of the Bordeaux region in France fell under German control because the wife of the leader was arrested, and in order to protect her, the leader turned traitor. With civil war, every country had more than one resistance group, and efforts were made to unite them, But in general, the communist resistance in Western Europe remains separate, but still would work along the same lines as the democratic resistance. But in certain areas, particularly the Balkans, they were directly opposed, and they actually fought civil wars during the World War.
In the Balkans, the case of Yugoslavia was especially complex. Ostensibly, two main resistance groups were fighting the Germans, the pro-monarchist Serb Chetniks under Draža Mihailović and the communist partisans led by Josip Tito. Both sides vied for arms supplies from the Allies, but increasingly they fought each other rather than the Germans, while also undertaking bouts of ethnic cleansing and waging a battle against perceived collaborators. Both sides committed barbaric atrocities and, when it suited them, were not above cooperating with the Germans.
Can we just look at France in a little bit of detail? Because it's a very interesting case study, this question of how complicated the situation could get, because you had a predominantly communist resistance, but many other groups as well. And on top of that, you had the division between Vichy France and the Free French, and de Gaulle's particularly complicating character on top of it all. Tell me a little bit about the situation in France and how complicated that could get.
Everyone assumes that French resistance was de Gaulle, and yes, there was a communist resistance. They're not necessarily predominantly communist. The French communists have said 75,000 martyrs, and it's been pointed out that there probably weren't 75,000 people in the resistance anyway. So you have to be a little careful about that. But there certainly was the difference between the occupied part of France and the unoccupied part of France. Obviously, because in one part, it was clear the enemy was the Germans, and in the southern part, they didn't have the Germans as neighbours, and they were split in their attitude even to Vichy France. But the change really comes towards the end of 1942, when the Allies invade North Africa, and the Germans then invade southern France. The Americans are extremely hostile to de Gaulle. The British tolerate de Gaulle. They see him as probably the best leader. But the occupation of France meant there was now a new potential leader, and that was Giraud, who'd been taken prisoner of war in 1940, but then escaped from custody, got back to France, was smuggled out of France, and the Americans promoted his interests, and the British were still sponsoring de Gaulle. In the midst of this, you get de Gaulle's emissary to occupied France, Jean Moulin, parachuting in and trying to unite the resistance. Just at the moment when he thinks he's achieved his goal, he's betrayed and arrested. And so the successors renew the squabbling. De Gaulle unites the country in September 1944 after the Germans have left by a whistle-stop tour around the country that writes the new narrative of the French resistance, that it was united, it never was, and that the British had nothing to do with it, which they did.
The messy divide in occupied France between collaborators and resistors is underlined by the fact that some 32,000 French men and women worked for the Gestapo and almost 30,000 for the proto-fascist paramilitary Milice. Operation Torch, the Allied invasion of North Africa that began in late 1942 and in which thousands of Vichy French troops were killed by British and American forces, saw many French people abandon Pétain as hopes rose of direct Allied support for the resistance, who now launched increasing attacks on the Milice in what amounted to a low-level civil war. Torch gave fleeting prominence to General Henri Giraud, commander of the anti-Vichy French forces in North Africa. But de Gaulle was able to sideline him and emerge after D-Day as the de facto leader of a liberated France.
Can I turn now to SOE? SOE figures very prominently in writing about espionage and resistance behind the lines, but they, in a sense, being emissaries of the British government and in many cases having to represent the views of governments in exile, did find themselves in a particularly fraught political situation, didn't they, when they got parachuted in and found themselves amongst partisans?
SOE was set up, in Churchill's words, to set Europe ablaze. In fact, Europe was already ablaze and already learning lessons about resistance before SOE really got going. The first agents didn't get into occupied Europe till 1941 and didn't really achieve anything that year. The main purpose and use of SOE was to organise the resistance, to provide weapons for them, to train them in the use of it, and to direct their efforts towards Allied goals. And it's that last part, Allied goals, that provides a great problem, particularly, again, in the Balkans. The mission to Greece grew out of not planning that SOE would now have a new presence in Greece, but simply an SOE party had been sent in to blow up a viaduct. And when they reached the coast expecting the submarine to collect them, they were told, no, you're now the British mission to Greece. And they were very unhappy about it. The problem was that the two resistance movements that they encountered in the mountains of Greece were both Republican. Britain at that time was hosting the King of Greece, and so they were expecting the restoration of a royalist government. And instructions from the Foreign Office, looking in the long term, were saying we must find resistors who support the King. SOE, who is operating the short term for military goals, is saying, well, I'm sorry, the only resistors are Republicans. The resistance is invited to Cairo to talk to the Greek government in exile, and the damning port on it is, Myers brought out the wrong sort of Greeks. That led to civil war between the two Republican groups, and it meant that when the Greek government returned to Greece towards the end of 1944, it came accompanied by British troops who very soon had to turn their weapons on Elas, the communist Republican group, who were potentially going to overthrow the government. Elas is precisely the group that the British had armed themselves. In Albania, the British arrived and were promptly turned back and told to go back across the frontier until they'd been invited in. They had very little control over events in Albania at any time. And in Yugoslavia, the presence of the British missions there actually made things worse. The most verbally able SOE agents went into the partisans, and those more practically minded went to the Chetniks. And so when both sides were asked to present reports on the future of resistance in Yugoslavia, the one that was the best written was the one that got to Churchill, and Churchill said, OK, we support these people. They didn't have the air power to supply both groups. They had to make a choice. This was all aided by SOE Cairo, where there were a number of extreme left-wingers who would hide the reports in favour of the Chetniks who supported the Yugoslav government in exile and promote those reports of people with the partisans.
It's amazing, looking at that situation, that these groups even bothered to take notice of SOE, but presumably there was very substantial weapons assistance and that kind of thing, which they couldn't really turn down.
Well, certainly weapon supply was used as a means of control. If you shoot people from other resistance movements, we won't provide you with any more weapons. That worked until September 1943 with the defeat of Italy, because Italy was occupying large parts of the Balkans. And so all the weapons from the disarmed Italians went to the various resistors, and by that time SOE had largely stopped having any effect on what was going on in the region. An example is, as the Germans were retreating through Yugoslavia, the British drew up plans for the Yugoslav partisans to do a lot of damage to the German forces. Tito agreed that this is what the partisans would do. On the very same day, he gave directions to his commanders, we turn east to Serbia.
By the summer of 1944, with the Red Army approaching and the Germans withdrawing from the region, all communist resistance groups in the Balkans prioritised the post-war settlement. In Albania and Bulgaria, as well as Yugoslavia, this meant crushing non-communist rivals and settling scores. In Serbia, the Soviets took Belgrade in the autumn of 1944, and Mihailović offered to assist them against the Germans. But the Russians simply arrested the Chetnik emissaries, dispatching them to Moscow, and thereafter handed over any Chetniks to Tito's partisans, who promptly executed them.
What's your verdict on SOE? Was it effective at all? What kind of influence did it have in the end?
In the Balkans, it didn't have any effect at all. In Western Europe, it certainly helped organise the resistance, helped them select goals and targets. And above all, it made the people in occupied Western Europe know that they hadn't been forgotten by their allies and that they could be supported to make some sort of impact towards their own liberation. That moral effect is probably the most important.
You have a lot of interesting things to say about the role played by resistors as it became more obvious that the Germans were on the back foot and were losing, particularly when we get to 1944, 1945. This must have galvanised the resistance, but at the same time it would have greatly complicated matters, wouldn't it? Because different groups were starting to jockey for position in the new post-war order that they envisaged.
Well, different countries had a different vision of the post-war world. In Western Europe, they were generally in favour of the restoration of a liberal democracy, although quite a number of papers were written by the resistors and indeed the exiled governments on reorganising the economy. Because you have to remember, the Second World War followed swiftly after the Great Depression, which in many ways had been an indictment of liberal democracy. But there were those who were in favour of communism. In France, they were never going to overthrow the government, but in the Balkans, certainly they planned to. They failed to in Greece, largely because Stalin would not support them at that stage. And they succeeded in Eastern Europe, where the communists were a much smaller resistance movement, but they had the might of the Red Army to support them, and in particular the NKVD, that is the forerunners of the KGB, to arrest their political opponents for them.
In Poland, for example, a positively Kafkaesque situation arose after the final Soviet takeover. The true resistance against the Germans found themselves labelled as collaborators, simply because they weren't communists. Thousands of surviving members of the AK, the underground Polish Home Army, were hunted down by the new secret police and ended up in prison cells alongside their previous Nazi persecutors. Across Soviet-occupied Eastern Europe, the resistance narrative was now rewritten exclusively to glorify the communist struggle, which in reality had barely existed in any country in the region except Tito's Yugoslavia.
If we can just go back a step or two, we've talked a lot about communist resistors and communist partisans. Why were the communists so prominent in these resistance pockets? One can understand it in countries which were previously Soviet occupied, which had a pretty terrible time. But why in places like France and Italy, where there was some communist activity before the war, but it wasn't that enormous? Why was this such a strand in resistance?
The communists had the advantage that they'd often been banned at various times, and so they'd already learned how to operate in a clandestine manner. So they knew how to build up cells so they wouldn't be penetrated. They already had an underground press, which the other resistance movements had to create from scratch. There was also the memory of the defeat. We've had, by that stage, a decade of extreme depression, extreme poverty. And now the governments couldn't even protect the territory of the country. And so there was this feeling, you know, let's look for some new solutions. And of course, at that time, the communists in Western Europe were not aware of the full impact of Stalinism. They neither knew about the Great Terror. They knew that there had been change of personnel, but not the scale of it. And they certainly did not believe about the famine in Ukraine at all. They were idealistic communists rather than Stalinist communists.
And presumably they had the example of the Spanish Civil War prior to the Second World War. And of course, once Soviet Russia became an ally in 1941, that presumably would have made a difference?
It made a difference in that the communists had been ordered from the Comintern not to take any part in the resistance until the Germans invaded. So there's this embarrassing period which the communists and Soviets prefer to forget, the time of the Nazi-Soviet pact, when the communists did nothing. But certainly in France, the Vichy government rounded up a number of them. In the Spanish Civil War, the Spanish Republicans had been fighting for years and had then retreated over the Pyrenees. Most had been imprisoned in French concentration camps, but a number escaped, and they provided leadership for the communist resistance, but also helped out in other resistance movements because they had the experience.
And do we know if the Soviet Union actively helped any of these resistance groups in different countries? I mean, for instance, in Yugoslavia, was there direct help or was the relationship a bit too edgy?
Well, it wasn't so much it was edgy. The Comintern, immediately after the invasion of the Soviet Union, called for communists in all countries to rise up and take immediate action against the Germans. And secondly, to produce this idea of a popular front and work with the other resistance movements, but take them over from within. There was then very little direct contact between the Comintern and Western Europe. There was contact with Tito, but they were often reining him back, saying, you know, don't call your shock troops proletarian guards. That will put people off you. This is really when Tito had the first inklings of an independent line that would lead him to split with Stalin in 1948. They weren't able to provide aid to Yugoslavia. They tried to pretend that they did. They sent advisers, but those advisers had no powers to order airdrops. The only countries the Soviets could get weapons to were basically the Czech Protectorate, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. It was mostly into Poland and into the Czech Republic, where they thought that the path of the Soviet advance would go. It made sense to have friendly partisans on the ground.
In the Soviet Union, partisan numbers swelled as the Germans began their long retreat from 1943 onwards. After the war, the Soviet partisan struggle was mythologised on a heroic scale, first by Soviet historians, than by their Western counterparts. It's now conceded that they had a limited impact on the fighting. Moreover, the reality was that most Soviet partisans were not independent volunteers, but were recruited by the Red Army from the remnants of the Soviet forces crushed by the German advance of 1941.
Jumping forward now to the liberation, you tell some very compelling narratives about resistance groups which jumped the gun a bit, acting too soon before the Allies got to them and getting burned as a result.
Well, there was this feeling across Europe that we want liberation, but we want to liberate ourselves. They weren't powerful enough to do that. You know, this image of the ill-equipped partisan taking on the might of the German army, first of all, isn't true, and secondly, when they did try to do so, they led to a considerable number of deaths. But there were efforts of liberation. I mean, the first example I really give is Vercors, the plateau near Grenoble in France, where soon after D-Day, they seized control of the plateau and expected aid to come from the French forces in North Africa. And instead, when the gliders arrived, which they thought would have French reinforcements on board, instead the SS leapt out and massacred the Maquis on Vercors. And that happened with various other towns in France as well. But the three great uprisings are the Warsaw Uprising, when again the Poles wanted to liberate Warsaw ahead of the Soviets entering, so that they would, in a way, grant permission to the Soviets to enter the Polish capital. Of course, that didn't happen. The Soviets halted on the other side of the Vistula and watched as the Germans massacred the Poles for them. In Paris, it was different because the Allies were nearby, but the Americans had absolutely no intention of sending troops to liberate Paris, for the simple reason they didn't want the responsibility to feed the people of Paris, and they wanted to carry on driving eastwards into Germany. It was only when Paris rose up and there was a lull in operations on the front that troops were sent and liberated Paris. But the Germans were genuinely retreating. There was none of the brutality that you had in Warsaw. Indeed, there were ceasefires so that the Germans could retreat through Paris unhampered, with the promise that they wouldn't attack the resistance on their way through. You don't get any of that friendliness anywhere else. The third example is Slovakia, which is the Forgotten Uprising. That happened in September 44. And unlike the Poles, who were chided by the Soviets for "you didn't consult us," in this case the Slovaks did consult the Soviets, and the Soviets gave them no clear answer. And indeed, when the Slovaks rose up, the Soviet front promptly went round the edge of Slovakia into Hungary, leaving the Germans to massacre the Slovaks alone. The only country where uprisings tended to work was Italy. The first being in September 1943 in Naples, 4 great days in Naples of self-liberation, but the Allies were just down the road. And similarly, in April 1945, as the Germans were desperately retreating from the northern industrial cities, they all rose up and liberated the cities from the Germans and presented perfectly working utilities and local government in these cities to the Allies, who wanted to impose their own administration.
So the pattern seems to be that where uprisings were actively assisted by the Allies in one way or another, not necessarily by sending in armed troops, but simply by their physical presence in the proximity, then uprisings tended to work. Was that right?
It was right if it was the Western Allies. But the Soviets were taking over the countries that, you know, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and all across Eastern Europe. They were advancing to take over and impose new regimes on these countries. So they were not interested in the liberation of them. Examples come from what happened with Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. These had been on Hitler's side for much of the war and had spent a long time trying to wriggle out of commitments to him. So if you jump too early and switch sides, as Hungary did, you get occupied by the Germans. If you leave it too late, as the Bulgarians did, then the Soviets invade and take over. But the Romanians, interestingly enough, timed their switch of sides perfectly as the Soviets were arriving. It made no difference at all. The Soviets were still going to impose their own regime on the country.
An awful lot's been written about D-Day, and in particular the role of the resistance in D-Day. What's your verdict, or what's the consensus now about how effective the French resistance was before and after D-Day? Did it make a real difference to the outcome, or have we been misled by the mythology of France liberating itself that was so prevalent after the war?
Well, certainly France did not liberate itself. There were various stages at D-Day the French resistance was very active blowing up all the railways. Later research has shown that some German units were delayed on their way to the Normandy front, but in fact others, most famously Das Reich, coming from southwestern France, was not delayed as much as the French resistance would like. Certainly the Germans felt very vulnerable, but the point is, the moment that the French liberated a town, if the Germans felt threatened from that, they could take those towns back, and they did, with extreme brutality. I mean, it's during that time you get the Oradour-sur-Glane massacre, which is bringing Eastern methods of warfare to France.
Oradour-sur-Glane ranks as the worst German atrocity in France. 4 days after D-Day, on its way north to reinforce the Germans in Normandy, the SS Panzer Division Das Reich entered the village. All the men were separated and then machine-gunned. The women and children were locked in the church, which was then set on fire. Any survivors trying to escape were shot. All the houses were destroyed and the livestock slaughtered. In total, 642 civilians died.
But there were certain areas where the resistance really did help. One was the provision of intelligence, and that was absolutely vital. They'd been providing intelligence on the location of the V weapons, which is one thing the Allies needed to neutralise as soon as possible, but also just local intelligence. In that wood are hidden some planes that will be taking off from that field. Those were things that the Allies didn't know, locals did. They did make a great difference to the American invasion, Operation Dragoon, in August 1944 by blowing up all the bridges. This was a retreating German army in any case. It was beaten. They didn't want to get trapped in France, but it was the resistance who could tell the Americans just how fast they could advance safely and when they might have to stop and fight.
As we're talking about intelligence, this comes back to the question, how effective were the resistance groups? There were no real breakthroughs, were there, by clandestine groups in terms of intelligence?
There were breakthroughs. I mean, the breakthroughs came on the V weapons. That came entirely from the resistance. The problem was actually the intelligence analysis, because scientists in Britain were considering rockets by what they knew of rockets, which was actually wrong. And it was quite late on that they realised they were talking about two different weapons, the V1 and the V2. It was the Polish Home Army that rescued parts of the V2 and got them smuggled to Britain so that the V2 could be understood. And bits fell on Danish soil and again were smuggled into Sweden and got to Britain. So that's vital, but also the naval intelligence was extremely important. The Norwegians would report on the movements of the German capital ships and particularly kept a close watch on Tirpitz, which of course would affect the Allied convoys to the Soviet Union. The French boasted that at certain times U-boats could not leave French ports without being reported to Britain. And the longer reports on who was doing what, where and when, and if possible why, would be smuggled out of occupied Europe or radioed, but longer reports were taken overland into Spain or later into North Africa and sometimes into Switzerland or Sweden, the neutral countries, to get back to Britain. The intelligence was important, but it was often low-key. I mean, what people don't realise is you did not have to be a trained intelligence agent. Someone who was a seamstress in La Rochelle in Brest could listen to the gossip of the U-boat crews and get a good idea when their U-boat was going to go, pass that information on to someone who could radio it back, and the RAF might be able to sink the U-boat just as it's leaving harbour.
An aspect I knew nothing about was the role played by the resistance as the Germans retreated, which was to safeguard facilities and infrastructure which they possibly planned to destroy.
Well, counter-scorch was something that hadn't been planned for when most agents were trained and sent out. These orders came quite late, and I think it really came after the German retreat from Naples when they saw just how much damage the Germans were likely to make as they retreated. And so orders started going out, protect particularly ports from destruction. But it wasn't very romantic to protect stuff. And so in general, the resistors did not do perhaps as much as they should have done. But one notable example of when they did succeed was preventing explosions in Antwerp port. Had the Allies then opened up the Scheldt estuary, Antwerp could have been opened for supplies much earlier in the war than it was, and they needed that port. But that was the Belgian resistance. Probably the greatest achievement of the Belgian resistance, other than intelligence, was saving the port of Antwerp. But also with Toulon and Marseille, where they provided clear reports of what damage had happened and what ships that had been scuttled could then be lifted and moved out of the way. So those ports could be opened again sooner than had they not had that information.
Unsurprisingly, the numbers joining the French resistance grew exponentially once the Allies had landed. However, this flood of eager new résistants made the movement difficult to control. De Gaulle, for one, always worried that the communist underground would try to dominate, triggering a possible civil war in France. What we now know suggests that this was unlikely, and the impression remains that the resistance, which had no heavy weaponry, was less effective than popular accounts would have us believe. Research since, for example, has found that of over 200 French cities liberated, 70% were retaken by the Allies.
In the immediate aftermath of liberation, there followed a ferocious and bloody payback inflicted by resistors on native fascists and collaborators, and I was struck how high the numbers of deaths was here. I mean, one's used to images of, you know, girls having their hair shorn off or petty humiliations, but actually quite a lot of people were killed, weren't they, in different countries?
They were killed, particularly savage, in the months immediately after liberation in France. It took some time to restore law and order. A lot of it was against collaborators, especially against the milice, who were really seen as beyond the pale. But some of it were personal grudges being dealt with under the cover of war. In Italy, they were undoing over 20 years of fascism, so there was a lot of hatred. And in fact, that was sort of semi-officially sanctioned, whereas the French at least did try to impose a legal framework for trying the worst of the collaborators. Other countries generally said, look, we are creating a legal structure and we will examine people, like they did in Norway and they did in the Netherlands, to distinguish between those who collaborated because they wanted to and those who had to, or those who just didn't know better.
And is it true that there was a sort of grace period of a few days, a week, immediately after the liberation in some countries, when resistors or the locals were allowed to do what they wanted and revenge themselves on collaborators until law and order then was reimposed?
I think that certainly happened in certain parts of Italy, just because of the strength of feelings. In France, I think it was just simply a lack of control. But a lot of that is the Allies thinking that people want revenge. Often they planned for it, and indeed that happened after the liberation of the concentration camps. In some instances, they said, you know, we will turn our backs for 24 hours and you can do what you like to your former guards and to the capos, the prisoners who helped. A few were killed, but a lot of people just thought, no, actually, what's the point? And so there was more of a pent-up desire for revenge than actual deaths. But there was a lot of shunning of people for years after the war. I mean, even into the 70s, I come across examples of people, you know, we're not talking to her because we know how she got her apartment. And this is going back to wartime.
After the liberation in 1945... how effectively would you say resistance groups realised their ambitions and their desire to influence events in their own countries? Is there any sort of pattern we can discern here, or did it change from country to country, depending on the circumstances of liberation, not least?
I think it changed from country to country. I mean, certain countries like Norway and Denmark moved seamlessly to the restoration of liberal democracy, as indeed actually did Holland. In the case of the Netherlands and Norway, it's partly the popularity of their monarchs. In Denmark, they very carefully made half the post-war cabinet members of the resistance, just to acknowledge the contribution. In France, the resistance was generally ignored. De Gaulle put in his own people and caused a lot of offence by doing so. Italy, there were a lot of struggles for years afterwards. Yugoslavia is the one place where the country was taken over by its resistance movement. Tito took over the country. In Greece, there was then round three of the civil war. Rounds one and two had happened during the war. Not that many people wanted the royalist government, but they couldn't decide what sort of government, and the communists wanted to impose their government. Of course, the country where they lost was Poland in particular. That was a complete defeat for the democratic resistance, and many of them either fled the country or were smuggled out of the country in the following years. And even in the occupied Soviet Union, as we now know today, Soviet rule was not that welcome back. And the Ukrainians, who had formed their own insurgent army to fight for their independence, continued fighting for years after the war, but of course they didn't achieve independence till the 1990s.
So, as during the war itself, in the aftermath too, there was a broad divergence between Eastern and Western Europe, with the East seeing Nazi occupation largely replaced by Soviet repression. Indeed, we now know that many people who had collaborated with the German occupiers simply switched their allegiance to their new communist masters. As so often in war, but perhaps particularly in this war of unparalleled violence, personal survival at any cost could easily become a habit, trumping all other considerations. Not a choice, of course, that secret agents behind the lines generally enjoyed. Many died in action, but scores of SOE agents and hundreds of French résistants missing at the end of the war were eventually found to have been executed in German captivity. I've left till last the one group of resistors who knew they were fighting not for national liberation, but for the very survival of their race, the Jews.
I actually devote two chapters to the question of resistance to the Holocaust. One is the non-Jewish response to the Holocaust, and the other is the Jewish response to the Holocaust. Jews were notably active in West European resistance movements from the start, but they were fighting as Frenchmen, as Belgians, as Dutch people, rather than as Jews. It was in Eastern Europe, in the ghettos, that you can talk really about Jewish resistance, most of all. And there you have several dilemmas. First, the moral dimension of resistance. There's a captive population. How many people will be killed now if you resist, who may be killed later? And, you know, life in the ghettos was day by day. So this was a consideration. The other thing is they had no or very little assistance from outside. They didn't have SOE dropping weapons to them. They could get very little from local resistance groups for a variety of reasons, but principally because the timeline was different. With all resistance movements, the idea was to launch an uprising, or at least become more active, at the point when the Allies were winning the war. The height of the Holocaust was in 1942, in the first half of 1943, where the Germans were still dominant. And so the outside resistance groups would say, well, why resist? And the Jews were, we have to resist now. We can't choose our time. So the Jewish resistance was really not to liberate themselves or escape, although a number did. It was to say, you know, we'll have a few lines in the history book to show that we did not go as lambs to the slaughter. They certainly deserve recognition for what they did under extreme odds.
The charge was made during the war and afterwards that the Jews put up only passive resistance to their fate. but this ignores the fact that even Jews in the Polish ghettos, until late in the day, simply could not believe that the daily transports were taking them to camps not to work, but to exterminate them. Brutal German reprisals certainly inhibited active resistance, as did the ever-present fear of betrayal. It's a shock to learn that in the Netherlands, for example, some 60% of Jews in hiding were betrayed to the Germans, Anne Frank among them, suggesting widespread anti-Semitism. So acts of Jewish defiance tended to be individual and low-key, such as escaping from transports or ghettos. That said, large-scale Jewish resistance did happen as the full horror of German intentions sunk in. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of April 1943, not to be confused with the Warsaw Uprising of 1944, was a quite deliberate Jewish last stand. At the end, most of the surviving fighters, holed up in a bunker, killed themselves and their families. Revolts by Jewish prisoners also took place in the death camps of Treblinka and Sobibor, with scores escaping to freedom. But a large uprising at Auschwitz-Birkenau in late 1944 failed. No prisoners escaped, and up to 700 Jewish inmates died.
All resistance was essentially a minority activity, yet it seems to loom very large in the collective memory of liberated Europe after 1945. What does this tell us, do you think?
I think it shows people's need for self-respect. To say I resisted is to say I was never defeated. This is particularly true in the case of France, which had, in 1940, on paper at least, the largest, most powerful army in Europe, and yet was defeated in less than 6 weeks. And that shattered French morale and French self-belief. And so by resisting, they could help their allies liberate their country. They wanted to be able to look their liberators in the eye and say, I did something.
I've been discussing the underground war in Europe with Halik Kochanski, author of Resistance, published in 2022. If you want to know more on this subject, a short list of books can be found for this episode on the Explore Further page of the website. There's also a contact page, should you wish to leave feedback or ask questions. I'm always happy to respond. Do join me for other episodes in this series, which I hope has made you think. Or think again. If it has, please share with others. Thanks for listening.